We are up to Perek Chet, chapter 8, Pasuk Chaf Bet, sentence 22. And we read through the psukim here. We read through the last, well, not the last actually, but it's psukim Chaf Bet to Chaf Chet, sentences 22 to 28. And we asked certain questions already when we read through those sentences. The Jews asking Gideon if he would take a position of power. Gideon apparently refusing, saying, "I'm not going to rule over you. My kids aren't going to rule over you. Hashem is going to rule over you." He asks them for some gold. He then takes other gold from he took the Saharonim, those ornaments from the camels. Then he also asks the people to each give him a gold ring from their spoils. And he takes the gold and he makes it into an ephod, some kind of a tunic, which eventually people start to worship. It becomes an avodah zarah. And that, of course, is, you know, a problem. What in the world is Gideon thinking? Why is he asking for this stuff? Why does he make the ephod? Can it be that he, of all people, descends into idolatry? So let's actually go through the psukim themselves and see what it was that happened here. So we're starting from Pasuk Chaf Bet, sentence 22. And I'm not going to go through again the whole review of where we've been and Midian and Gideon and everything else. At this point, I'm going to rely on you to listen to the old audios for that. Vayomru Ish Yisrael al Gideon. So the Jews say to Gideon, don't get caught up in the fact that Ish Yisrael is singular. It means the Jews said to Gideon, Mishol banu gam ata gam bincha gam ben binecha. We want you to rule. We want your son to rule. We want your son's son to rule. And the use of the word gam here, the repeated gams, is something that we understand to mean, and even this, and even this, and even this, to accentuate the fact that it's a series. Similarly, when Yaakov sends his gift to Esav, and he instructs the people who are with each unit of the gift about what they're supposed to say to Esav, gam mes ha'ashini, gam mes ha'ashlishi, gam mes kol ha'olachim, acharei ha'adarim. The word gam is meant to emphasize to the reader that what they're asking for is in perpetuity. Gideon's family is going to be our dynasty. Ki oshatanu miyad Midian, because you saved us from Midian. Okay.
Have you ever done this with any of the other people who've
saved them? Not that we've seen, no.
Right. So now, it's kind of new, like they're on this way to him forever.
Well, it also raises a question. So was he a shofet at this point already, or was he not, that they're asking him to lead? It could be he's already a shofet, and they're saying to him, we also want this to be inherited, because normally being a shofet is not inherited. Normally it's earned.
But that sounds more like a leadership thing kind of thing.
Correct.
Because it's
inherited. Right, and that's actually Abarbanel's point. If you take a look on the sheet, it's source number one. Abarbanel and Roberta are on the same page. The practice among the Shoftim was, you got the position because of your might, because of what you did, not by your inheritance. It says, your son's son, but he's got, as we'll see, 70 sons. He has a lot of kids.
Whoa.
Yes, he had more than one wife.
Well, a lot of wives.
Yeah, he has quite a few wives and quite a few
daughters.
No, this is just sons. Well, you'll see why in the next parak. But he has
time for being a
and we complain.
Yeah. So he had 70 kids. So the question is, what do they mean when they say your son and your son's son? Like who? which one? So, you know, they say to him like, oh, we met your son Yehuda. Well, which Yehuda? Because there's no way that he only has one. So that's what Abarbanel says. They're mostly Yeser Bechora when they say your son, right? What they mean is the firstborn, the one that he wanted to train last time, right, when he wanted to kill Zebach and Salmuna, right? That's the one. Kitelecha mem shalav ben hagadol me'achav. I mean, because you always go with the eldest son, so that's the assumption. It doesn't always happen that way, but nonetheless.
Does yeter mean like extra? Like it's the firstborn.
So yeter could mean extra, but it doesn't have to. It's also the word for a bowstring. Like when you're going to fire a bow and arrow.
Okay.
So the string is called a yeter. So it doesn't have to be a negative like that. It also could mean greater than others, over and above.
Sorry.
So, I didn't know he was having all the rest of the kids. Right.
So, okay. So, you're not Canadian. You don't need to apologize. No,
that's not. She didn't do it. I understand that. Okay. Okay. So, okay.
So
they want Yeter to lead, and Gidon refuses, which I find interesting, because if they want Yeter to be the one, Yeter is the one who he had wanted to have as a leader. So why would Gidon now refuse?
Because he's so happy to come forward.
So one answer may be, he said, you know what? This isn't the one you want to have leading you. That's one possibility. But it's also possible to read this and say, maybe his refusal isn't exactly what it looks like. And that's what we're going to see now in the next pasuk. Look at what Gidon says. Vayomer alehem Gidon. Gidon said to them, Lo emshol ani bachem, I am not going to rule over you. Lo emshol bini bachem, my son isn't going to rule over you either. Hashem emshol bachem, God will rule over you. Is that refusal of the throne?
Maybe not.
Well, because I just said,
yeah.
I wouldn't ask the question otherwise.
God is really the one ruling over you, so it's not us, you know.
Right.
Or it's not. Obviously, we're going to be there, but.
Right. So the simple read is that yes, he's refusing and he's not going to become the leader, and that's it. That's a simple read as I would have read it, you know, walking in. And the Medrash Tanhuma reads it that way. If you take a look at source number two. Commenting on the pasuk in Mishlei, v'lifnei kavod anava, right? Humility precedes honor. The rest of that pasuk is more famous. It's the one that gets translated always in English, pride goeth before the fall. That's the rest of the pasuk. But this half of the pasuk is the part that we're interested in. Humility precedes honor. Zeh Gidon aviv. That refers to his father Gidon. Meaning the father of Avimelech, because that's the other piece of this, is Avimelech, who does take over eventually, who's a real problem. But this is Gidon, father of Avimelech. Sheksha'omru lo, mishol banu gamata, gam benecha, gam ben benecha. When they say, we want you to take over, we want you to rule. Amar lem lo, mishol anibachem, he said, I'm not going to reign over you, which makes it sound like he was humble. He refused the throne, and actually the Medrash goes on to say that Gidon says in three steps, I will not rule over you, my son will not rule over you, and Hashem will rule over you, three statements, and so the Medrash says that's why Abimelech, his son, merits to rule for 3 years, despite being grossly unworthy, which we'll find out about.
They're not kings yet.
Well, Abimelech is more or less going to be king, but you'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one idea, and it's going to fit with the end of the Perek, which is going to say that the Jews did not take care of Gidon's family. They did not return the favor that he had done for the nation. Yes, because Gidon refused it. Gidon said, I don't want it, and they did not say, oh, well, we want to do something for them anyway. They said, okay, bye. And that's one take. But I know you'll be shocked to know that Abarbanel disagrees. Because why would he do that? Well, Abarbanel disagrees. He says no. That's actually not what happens here. Gidon's statement is that he and his descendants will rule, but only in the name of Hashem. We are ruling as Hashem's king, not because we want a war. That's not the way that you should look at us. And we'll see how that plays into his commentary on the rest of the Perek. But it makes a lot of sense as you read the story and see what happens to think that actually he did end up ruling. His declining was, not pro forma, but his declining was to make a point. And then he ended up ruling just in the name of Hashem. By the way, generally speaking, if you name your son Avimelech, right? That's usually a sign that you did have some sense of ruling. Literally, Abimelech means my father is king.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a name that was, among the Plishtim, a hereditary name of a king, right? Abimelech going back to the Chumash. So, you know, this isn't the name that you give your kid if you're shying away from monarchy.
Abimelech refers to God.
You could.
Abimelech.
Right, Abimelech would have been a better choice,
mm-hmm.
if that were what he meant. And Mitzvah David, by the way, is going to support this as well later on in the Perek. So keep in mind this debate about whether Gidon ends up ruling or not ruling, because it's going to matter in terms of how we read the ensuing psukim. Okay. So, Pasuk Chaf Dalet, in sentence 24, Vayomar Lehem Gidon, Gidon says to them, Eshala Mikem She'ela. I'm going to ask you for a favor. And again, I think I noted this last time, She'ela is not question, She'ela is request. Usnuli Ish Nezem Shalolo. I want each of you to give me a ring from his spoils, because they wore these rings. Last time we talked about are these nose rings, earrings. There's some kind of facial ring, as we'll see. But they have them because they're Yishmaelim, and Yishmaelim wear rings. So they're into rings. It's a kind of weird comment to show up in the Navi like that. But the big question for us is, they're not Yishmaelim. They are?
Midianim.
Mm-hmm. So, what do you mean?
Bracketed here. Like, it's actually bracketed.
Really?
Not very much. In English.
Wow. Well, I think they're just bracketing it just to show this is an offhand
like,
comment.
By the way.
Yeah. But take a look on your sheet, please, at Radak. Mm-hmm. Radak sees an opportunity here to explain a pasuk that gives us a very hard time in Chumash. He says, number three, Midyanim heim Yishma'elim. The Midyanim are identified as Yishma'elim. Ki b'nei Keturah heim uktirah hi Hagar. Right? We talked about this when we talked about where Midyan came from in the first place. We talked about how Keturah has these other kids, and Avram sends them away with gifts. So those kids are, among them, Midyan. That's one of the families. So they are sons of Keturah, and Keturah, we are told in the Medrash, is Hagar. And of course, Hagar has another son by the name of Yishmael. So it's all in the family, they're first cousins. But then he uses this to explain a pasuk. We actually asked this question a while back. In the sale of Yosef, right, who was responsible for the sale of Yosef? Because on the one hand, the pasuk says, "Vayim shachu bayalu as Yosef min habor." They drew him out. Vayim kuras Yosef la Yishmaelim ve'asurim kasef. They sold him to the Yishmaelim, which sounded fairly clear. But on the other hand, it says, "Vaham midanim machru oso el Mitzrayim." The Midianites sold him to Egypt. So what happened here? Mm-hmm. And people go into all sorts of different contortions to try to explain the pasuk. And Radak says, no problem. Just learn Navi. He says, V'chem v'b'chiras Yosef, v'im gruas Yosef la Yishmaelim, v'achar kenomar, v'amadanim, achruas al Mitzrayim. Yeah, because they're all the same group.
Where do you draw the line there? We're also related to Yishmael too, so we're all one people. So, right? So,
and we are to a certain extent. Yeah. Meaning the pasuk says regarding
Esau. Don't say the Jews are Yishmaelim, by any means.
I would hope not. But I think that, first of all, the Torah does go out of its way to describe the Jews as the brothers of Esav. We find it in Chumash, Los Eibadomi Ki Achichahu, don't reject the Edomite, he is your brother. And we find it in Navi as well, that Esav is viewed that way. If you think of like Ovadia's Nivua and others, they describe him as brother. You're right, though. They don't say we are Esav and we are Yishmael, probably because from an ideological perspective, we are so different from them that it doesn't make sense to identify as
together. But they're from a mother, like Keturah, Hagar, like they're brothers right. From the same mother.
And it's a funny thing because what you're doing is you're going down the tree. In other words, it makes sense for people to say we are all of the family of Abraham, and therefore we are all part of the family, we could be identified as a unit. It doesn't make sense to go down one branch of the family tree, pick a name that's further down, and use it to go up the tree and then, you know, identify all the cousins. That's really why this is challenging. If you had called them all B'nai Keturah or B'nai Hagar, yeah, then you would have been fine. Doing it this way does sound strange. The other challenge with it, in terms of his application of it to Yosef, is why did the psukim change right there? In other words, if you call them Yishmael Apostolico, why are you calling them Midyan now? It's not like Yaakov and Yisrael, or Gidon and Yerubal, as we're going to see, where those are two names of the same person, and maybe there's a way to explain what's going on. These are really different tribal names that may be associated with them, but you had no reason to shift your association.
Maybe they're similar type people, like they're nomads, or whatever they are. Maybe
it's showing that they got the custom from them. Yeah, maybe. Both of those are legitimate possibilities. Another possibility is, remember the pasuk regarding Yishmael, the closing pasuk in his appearance in Chumash, so to speak. He spread out across his brothers. It could be that over the course of the generations, and remember, you're talking centuries here, the identity of Yishmael becomes absorbed by the local populations, much in the same way that people use the term Arab to describe people who are not biologically, genetically Arab.
Armenians.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's just a flat-out mistake when people do that for Iranians. Iranians, they'll take the Persian Gulf and they'll, you know, sort of adopt, you know, everything together. But it could be that Yishmaelite just becomes the generic name. You know, a person who lived in that general area where the Ishmaelim dominated. Because remember, it's not in Canaan, it's east of Canaan, it's out in the desert. So maybe that's an answer as well. So whoever these are, and again, whether they the Torah wants to tell us something, another wants to tell us something specific about Ishmaelim and rings, I don't know. But he collects the rings. Vayomaru, and they said, Nasona titain. We're going to give. Vayifrasu as hasimla. And they spread out the cloth, which is interesting. There's a phrase in Chumash, Parsu hasimla, that also shows up, but I can't think of any association. But they spread out some big dress, cloth, whatever this is. Vayashlichu shama ish nezim shalalo. And everybody throws in a ring. Everybody's good with this idea. Which is kind of funny, like I would have expected at this stage, given what we've seen already with Sukkot and Penuel and Ephraim and all these, I would have expected someone to say, no, I'm not giving you a ring.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really there if they took it from there now.
Yeah, but I mean, their complaints beforehand were petty. Ephraim has complained, why didn't you call me to the war earlier? I mean, really?
Maybe there was so much of it. Or
I think that had you read this and the sentence would have said, and they said no, you would not have raised an eyebrow.
Right. Well, maybe they learned their lesson, what he did to the other people. Could be
they learned from what happened to Sukkot and Penuel. Like, when you say no to Gideon, you're
in trouble.
So I think we're going to give the ring now. How many rings would you like, Gideon?
The same kind of people who are, but they're not. Like, they're not supporting him. These people came to him, we want you to be our leader, whatever. The other people didn't do that. They're fighting him, they're not giving them food, they're turning
away. Well, he hadn't proved himself yet. No, he's
right, it could be. Or it could be that these are actually the people who were his soldiers. Oh. It's possible these were the 300. And if these are the 300, then we understand they're the ones who were loyal to him from the beginning.
It's interesting that he's asking for payment.
Right, so that's part of the question, is what is he asking for? So look what happens in the next pasuk. Vayihi mishkal nizmei hazahav asher shal, the weight of the gold that he asked for was elef ushvamei hazahav, 1,700 gold whatevers. Units. Levad minas saharonim, aside from those camel ornaments that he had taken, vanitifot, as well as nitifot. Nitifot, three different etymologies are possible. Rashi from the Targum says that it's klila, a crown. And then I don't know what the etymology is. I don't know how you get from crown to nun tet pei. Radak and Ralbag say that one of the spices that we identify in the Keteres is nataf. So maybe it's a bowl that they use to hold nataf, to hold this spice. Or alternatively, dat mikra, I think they're basing it on the word notaf, which is to drip, says that these are things that hung from necklaces and bracelets. So pendants, right? I think it was someone said last time, pendants, gold, silver, gems, whatever. So it's some kind of, also, some nice kind of an ornament. Ubigdeha argaman. As well as the royal purple clothing, Shal Malchi Midyan, that they had from the kings of Midyan, Ulevad ben Ha'anakos, Asher Bitzavarek Malehem, and the necklaces from their camels. So, Gideon does nicely. Sorry?
What didn't you mean on the
Saharan? The Saharanim, I had the impression, were more like a shield, almost, on the camel. It's like a semicircle of gold, right? Saharanim, we trace to the word Siara, which is the moon. It's like a half moon. So I think that may be different from this necklace, which is just decorative on the camel. But what does he do? It's not wealth for himself. Although I don't know actually what happens with the nitifot and the argaman, meaning if the nitifot are not gold, I'm not sure. What's coming next is going to be the use of the gold, but it's not going to explain what he's doing with the purple clothing. Abarbanel just thinks he kept them. Abarbanel says that was his due. He was the one who led everybody to war. The general who leads everybody to war gets a bonus. This is his. Malbim actually says, I brought it on the sheet. If you take a look at number 4. Malbim says this is far less than what he could have taken. This is testifying to Gideon's goodness. After it told that he did not pursue authority, it told that he hated prophets. Which is a good trait for a leader. That's one of the traits that Moshe looks for in leadership. He had a right to claim half the spoils. He took a small thing, and as a gift, not, this is my right, I get to take it. The idea of half, I think, is probably from the war with Midian, the original war with Midian, in Parshas Matos, where we talk about how half went to the army and half went to the rest of the Jewish people. So I think that he would be viewed as sort of head of the army, and he gets to take half. Maybe he would distribute some with his people, but he clearly has a right to far more than one ring per person and, you know, camel jewelry.
Is this the only other time besides the Edo that they have to give these maids a house? I'm just curious.
Right, that's an interesting question.
Well, became idolatry, like, technically, right?
Right.
It's not a good thing to give them.
Right. If someone asks you for gold, you should run the other way. It's an interesting question. With a Mishkan, they donated.
That was the Nizamim made that. Did it also use the term?
Did they use Nizamim?
With the Shkalim?
Well, they were the Shkalim, but they also brought materials.
Was it jewelry as well?
Well, they brought mirrors, we know. Marot had sellboat. You have to really look in Parshas Truma. In Parshas Truma, that's where you would identify the what it is that we're told they brought, and whether it specifies what the gold was before they donated it. It wasn't bars of gold. It had to be something specific. They didn't just have random gold around. But what it is a good question. You have to go look around. Look in Tanakh for what happens when people start soliciting donations of jewelry. Okay. So he keeps, apparently, the purple wool. He keeps, apparently, the whatever gems were involved in these nitifot, if there were gems. But everything else is not for himself. And it goes back to B's question. Is this greed? What is he asking for? Vayas oso Gidon le'ephod. Gidon made it into an ephod. Vayatzeg oso v'iro be'ofra. And he put it on display in his city in Ofra. Vayiznu chol Yisrael acharav sham. And all the Jews strayed after it. Vayihila Gidon ulubeso le'mokation. It was a stumbling block for Gidon and his household. And in general, when you see the word liznot, that always means one of two things. It always means either Gilui Arayos or Avodah Zarah. It's always either immorality or idolatry. And in this case, clearly, this is becomes an idol of sorts, something for them to worship. So,
just a piece of clothing, like the.
Well, it's gold. Okay. Yeah. But it's not just that.
It's not a figure, though. It's not like a.
Right. But it's a celebration of a miraculous victory over Midian. And so it becomes sort of the embodiment of the miracle that they had. But let's ask the question first, which is, what was Gideon thinking? Why did he think that he should make an ephod out of gold from this? What did he wake up that morning thinking? And he said, oh yeah, that's a good plan. What was he trying to do? What would you think?
Think about, like, I don't know, Statue of Liberty or... like a memorial.
Statue of Liberty is a gift of peace from the French to thank us for inspiration in the French Revolution.
You go to celebrate and show your
happiness.
I have no idea. Well, because it's what was taken from the
war.
Turned into a monument to appreciate God.
Yeah, because it's like the what the Kohen wore that to thank God, as the Torah says.
So it's about thanking God. So we're going to thank God by taking some of the spoils and making a jacket out of them.
Well, say
bud. I mean, of all the things he creates.
What's he doing with all those earrings?
Well, he's melting them down into this. I don't know. Maybe he could have made, I don't know, a decoration for the Mizbeach in the Mishkan. The Mishkan exists. Make a decoration for it. I don't know. It's just, it's a strange thing to make.
Well, it's a placement that he puts it in his city, even though...
See, what I should have done, I should have noted, but I did not, is that the ephod in general is something that is often associated with worship. Not just Big Day Kahuna, but ephod utrafim is a phrase that we find elsewhere. I think Micha maybe is the one who makes the Ephod and Trafim, but it's something that becomes a tool and focus of Avodah Zarah. In other words, you sort of could have seen this coming.
He should have.
So the question again is, so what was this? So the simple read is, as has already been suggested here, that it is meant to mark the victory, but to mark it in a particular way. Rashi, Radak, Ralbag, Malvim all offer a suggestion, which I brought you from Rashi in number 5. Lezikaron al Shu'a Gedola, right, as a memorial for the great salvation. Liros kama haya chelam kaved, to see how great their forces were. That from the rings taken from their most important people, you already had so much gold that you could make an ephod out of it. The point was simply to say, look how great their forces were. And that's one approach, which, as I said, is very common among the commentators.
It doesn't seem to fit with his God is going to rule you, God is, you know, whatever. It's not the force of the army that won it. It was God who helped them.
But it also celebrates the miracle. Look how great the miracle was. That
there were only 300.
Right, there were so many of them.
We got all this spoils.
Right.
And we made this huge kind of memorial.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe it's the Chisaron and Gidon.
In the sense that?
He's saying, I don't want to be your king, but I do want some honor, really.
So that's the question, is this for him? It sounds like, the assumption is it's not. The assumption right now is that it's not for him. It's actually to commemorate the victory and credit God.
But where is it placed?
In his city in Ophrah.
Oh, in his city. I thought it's not in his entrance.
Sounds like it's really big. Like, if you're hanging it in the middle of your city, people will see. It's not a real, that you would wear.
We don't know how big this was. We don't know what units there are when you say 1,700 gold something. I don't know what that means. Except that it sounds like a large number, whatever it was. A second approach is Rabbi Avram ben Arambam, who does see it as a mistake. Rabbi Avram, son of the Rambam, wrote on various diverse things, and he also wrote responsa. And this is the responsa of this. Someone asked him what the story was with this ephod. And his answer is, Gidon lo asaha ephod sheyiyah avod azara v'yavdullah, it's source number 6. Gidon did not make the ephod in order for it to be idolatrous, such that people should worship it. It was to be his own memorial in Israel. People should remember what I did. So I'm going to make a statue. Not a statue, I'm going to make an ephod. He says, that was a mistake. Shani quotes you, the Pasuk Shkiyos Miyavin, who could understand mistakes, meaning that if we make mistakes, we don't realize that we do things that are foolish. And this was Gidon's foolish error. V'iralia do hamechshol hagadol b'avodas misha avad lo miYisrael, but it led to a great stumbling block for Gidon, because there were among Israel some who worshipped it. V'im ki lo haya miskaven l'kach, he hadn't intended it. And what Rabbi Avram ben Arambam is trying to do there is to resolve the rest of this pasuk, which is an issue we have to deal with. It's an issue that we have to deal with, but I'm going to hold off on it. So hold off on the second half of his point. His first point is, Gidon intended it to be a monument for himself, and yeah, that wasn't really what he ought to have done. Abarbanel has a different take. Abarbanel believes, and we already said this, that Gidon actually did rule. Right? Remember, Abarbanel believes that Gidon did not decline as much as he tried to redirect. He said, don't look at me as the great one, I'm going to rule you, but God is really the one ruling you. So Abarbanel uses that idea for this garment. This is not a ceremonial ephod that's going to hang in the War Against Midian Hall of Fame. Gideon's going to wear this. It's a royal garment. Kind of heavy, but yes.
But that contradicts when they said he was so humble.
Yes, Abarbanel doesn't read it that way.
He doesn't read it that way at all.
Well, it's not necessarily an act of lack of humility, but he wants to get the people to follow through on their commitment. The people all said, we are going to follow you and your son and all that, and Gidon knows. A person only lives so long. How does he know that his kids and his grandkids are going to be given this? So he's going to create a ceremonial.
So Gidon thought that he was going to make a ceremonial golden robe that would not only be for him, but for the next king and the next king and the next king, and it would always remind people of how it is that his line became the royal line. That's the idea. So like the green jacket at the was the golf tournament,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The Masters.
Yeah.
So maybe not exactly.
Yeah, I think you get your own. I think you get the pound down.
Exactly.
Then it doesn't. Then that's not so big, right?
Right. Well, I don't know. But take a look at source number 7. This is where the piece. This is a piece from Abarbanel.
He didn't have his sacred zechunot at the Ahasuerus.
It could be he did, but he knows books don't always last. We don't have Ahasuerus's book.
That's true.
Vehine, Sha'al Gid'on Zel Ish Yisrael, Kfima Sha'achshov, Lolachem Daso. He says, Gid'on asked for this not out of desire. He wasn't greedy. Ratzah She'yitnu Kol Echad Nezem Zahav Le'yos HaMechubar El HaPeh. And this goes back to my emphasis on what these rings were. They're not rings for the finger. They're not a tabat. They're an earring. They're a nose ring. But the point is, it's something that's near the mouth. V'la sos mimenu ephod, to make this ephod out of it, v'hi chagbora omabush zahav, he says maybe it's a belt, maybe it's a golden garment, it's some kind of a tunic, shel bosh lichvodo, that he would wear for his honor, ula os ma'alaso, as a sign of his stature, v'yatzeg oso bi'iro l'zecher tishu osav. And he put it on display in his city to commemorate his salvations, the winning of the war. The gam kidei shaloti shachas mipizaro she Yisrael nadru v'shalmu liyos Gid'on ubanav moshlim aleim, and said everybody will remember that everybody said we want it. They even paid for it, for them to be the king. V'lachein asah levush yoreh al hamemshala asui miklei zahav ha'olech al hapeh, and he says that's why he used the rings that are near the mouth. It's like you committed with your word. So it makes more sense if it's a nose ring, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, it makes even more sense if it's a tongue ring, but I don't know if they did that. The Zecher Lamasha Dibru B'nei Yisrael B'fihem, to commemorate what the Jews said. V'haya imken me'ashmas Gid'on shlosam bitchono be'elokim. However, his guilt is that he didn't trust in God to watch over the monarchy of his descendants. V'chasha ba'osa derech lamshil banav. He thought he is going to be responsible for enthroning his descendants. And everything followed from there. So Abarbanel gives us a third take. We have Rashi, who says it was just a victory celebration. That's really all this was. You have Rabbi Avram ben Arambam, who says it was personal monument for Gid'on. Then you have Abarbanel, who says actually it was meant to enshrine in the annals of Jewish history that his children should be the dynasty because of this win. Last, I have to note this very strange medrash, which actually says, no, it was idolatry. And that was what Gid'on thought he was doing.
Source number 8.
After he declared all from God.
Because, you know, people make mistakes. Happens. Gimel Haim, Shenema Bahem Beseva Tova. The Pasuk is going to say for Gid'on when he dies, that he dies Beseva Tova at a ripe old age. So there are three people who get that description. Avraham, David, and Gid'on, right. So Avraham Haya Shavelo, right? David was the Haftarah last week. The Avraham was worthy of it. David Shavelo, David also. Gid'on lo Shavelo. But for Gid'on, this really wasn't such a good thing, having old age. Lama, why? Vayasa so Gid'on le'efod, la'avodas kochavim. Because in his old age, what did he do? He made this ephod for avodah zarah. It makes it sound, you could sort of read this as it was bad that he made this, and it led to idolatry, but it sounds to me like what it's actually saying is, this is why he did it. Even though he's in the start of his career, he is the anti-idol worship person. Mm-hmm. He's the destroyer of the altar and gets rid of their carbon. He is Yerubal. Nonetheless, at the end, he has problems.
Why are we so hard on Gid'on?
Right. So the reason why, and that's a perfect segue. The reason why we have difficulty with this, and we look at problems and say, yeah, Gid'on did something wrong, is because of the second half of the sentence. Vayihila Gid'on ulevei solem okesh. It was a stumbling block for Gid'on, or it was a trap, really. Mokesh is stronger than stumbling block. I don't know how they translate it there. But it's snare. Yeah, it's like a trap. It was a trap for Gid'on and for his household. What does that mean? If Gid'on was innocent, then what was this, snare for Gid'on? Now, Are you telling me that Gideon worshipped it? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Is that his father's Avodah Zarah now resurfacing where we thought that it was gone and he had defeated it? So that's the problem. And we have, you know, different ways to approach it. You could take it the way that Rabbi Avram ben Harambam did. That was the point that Rabbi Avram ben Harambam was making. If you go back to number 6, it was a stumbling block in that people ended up worshipping it despite his intent.
But maybe it was much after he made it.
Yeah. Well, Rabbi Avram ben Harambam believes that Gideon did not worship it. And pretty much every other Mefaresh that you will find, pretty much every commentary you will find in the classic commentaries on this sentence, say that the idol worship starts after Gideon is dead.
Right.
Gideon is not a worshiper of this. That Medrash aside, he didn't create it with that in mind. Mm-hmm. And the sense of, well, it caused him to stumble, or it was a trap for him, it was his downfall, simply means because it's on his record. Because at the end of the day, you made the idol.
You made it, right.
Yeah, Roberta, you want to say?
No, I was going to say it's like filming his memorial, you know, like it became his, like they want to memorialize him.
Yes, Gideon will be forever known as the creator of the ephod.
Yeah.
And that's one take on it. It also fits well because we're going to say in Pasuk Chavchet they had 40 years of quiet. If they were worshiping idols, why did they get 40 years of quiet? The answer is they had 40 years of quiet, Gideon died, and that's when the problems began. After Gideon was already gone was when this started. And that's a Barbanel's take as well, is that the Avodah Zarah was after Gideon died. If you take a look at source number 9.
Well, it makes sense. While Gideon was there, they had Gideon. They didn't need to look elsewhere.
Right. Could be.
Actually, though, if they were saying we want you and your son and whatever, why when he disappeared did they not go to his son?
The son wouldn't kill him.
Yes, the man didn't have to go.
Well, we see what happens with his son. It's coming up. But take a look at source number 9, please. Abarbanel, Masha Amar Vayiznu Kol Yisrael Acharav, when it said all Israel strayed after this ephod, Eino Bimei Gideon, it's not in Gideon's time. Not that Gideon made this to worship idols. God forbid, it would be a desecration. Keep in mind as well, Abarbanel's view that we saw 27 weeks ago, when we talked about what a shofate is. Right? Abarbanel's view is that all of the shoftim are righteous. Mm-hmm. Even the shofate who we will find murdering his siblings did it before he became shofate.
Even Abimelech coming up?
That's the one.
Oh.
Yes. Did it before the inauguration. This was beforehand. He became a different person once he became a shofet. Avol, who asal zikaron shu osav v'divrei Yisrael alav v'nifla osak hel yisbarach. Abarbanel says that, and this we saw already, Abarbanel believes that it was made to commemorate that which he had done and to make sure that they would honor their agreement to take care of his kids. And even make them the leaders. After he died, that's when things went bad. So that's the way that we generally look at the ephod. And when it says that it made him stumble, that it was a cause for stumbling or a trap for his household, doesn't mean that they worshipped it themselves. What it does mean, though, is they're responsible for where things went. So Pasuk Chavchet, sentence 28.
It also means it's the black stain on his reputation.
Yeah, which yes, it's
yeah, here he was, this paradigm of courage and avodat Hashem, and
yeah,
at the end he ruined it all.
Correct, and it only gets worse, by the way. Vayikana Midyan lifnei bnei Yisrael. Midyan was humbled before the Jews. Velo yasfu laseis rosham. They never raised their head again. And the land was silent for 40 years in Gideon's time. The 40 years, according to Ralbag, may not include the 7 years of slavery. However, the general chronologies that we find do say 40 years includes the seven. And that matters when they start trying to count up when the shoftim lived and who was after whom and so on. It's generally assumed that the 40 years includes the 7 years of slavery. Worth noting, this is actually true, meaning that Midian never raised their head again, meaning if you look through all of Tanakh, Midian is never a powerful enemy of the Jews from this point forward. Gideon has put an end to Midian. However,
an end to Midian or end to their adversity?
An end to them as a meaningful enemy. They exist.
That's a good legacy.
It is a good legacy. The problem is that Gideon also lost to Midian, in the sense that, go back to the beginning of our discussions about Midian, their theme is separating Jews from other Jews. Right, we saw that with Yosef, we saw that with Moshe, we saw that with Zimri and Cosby, and inducing immorality and idolatry. That's the theme. That whenever you see Midian, you see these things happen in the narrative. So we've already seen idolatry. The immorality isn't going to be far off. We just need another few sentences.
Is this a lesson telling us that we shouldn't be trying to create our own legacy purposefully?
That's interesting. In other words, his attempt to make a legacy for himself didn't pan out. Mm-hmm. So is that a lesson about seeking legacies in general? It's an interesting question. I mean, he gets criticized by Abarbanel, but that's largely because of not so much legacy as trying to cement the monarchy of his kids, and monarchy is in God's hands. So maybe that in particular is an overshoot, but not the idea of creating a memorial in general. I'm not sure.
Creating your own memorial.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Right. Well, there's
still... Right.
Yeah. Well, look, if you want them to say the right things, then, you gotta... I don't know. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure. So the end of the Perek and the end of Gideon's arc is seen in Psukim Chavtet to Lamed He. Here we go. We're going to read 29 to 35 and ask the questions that we have and then explain. Vayelech Yerubal ben Yoash Vayeshev Beveso. Yerubal, son of Yoash. Remember, that was also his name. We're going to have to talk about why suddenly we call him Yerubal. But Yerubal, son of Yoash, went home. Okay, I needed a pasuk to tell me that. Ule Gideon hayu shivim banim yotzei yirecho. He's got 70 biological kids. Kina shem rabos hayu lo, because he had many wives. Ufilag sho, and his concubine, because apparently having all those wives wasn't sufficient. Remember, concubine in Tanakh is understood to be not a full wife, in the sense that a wife has the protections that we associate with the ketubah. And there are all sorts of rules surrounding that relationship. Pilegesh doesn't have those protections. Pilegesh starts when they want it to and ends when they want it to. And there's no get, and you may recall.
Because of Yaakov.
The kids are 100% legitimate children.
Right, they get the same inheritance.
Right, so I don't remember how inheritance works. In Halacha, but you may recall, this was a big story like 20-something years ago. There were these guys in Brooklyn who wanted to resurrect the concept of Pilegesh. They thought that this was a really good idea.
They
have
them anyway.
More.
Not that.
No. Yeah, most of it was actually. Most of it was urban legend stuff. They created a hotline. There was in one of my communities, there was someone who actually called the hotline for his brother and gave his brother's name to for them to go. It was a prank. To apply for this. But more recently, there were actually those who wanted to argue, some semi-serious people, wanted to argue that a good way to solve the Aguna crisis would be to switch from marriage to Pilegesh as a model. Do away with the way that we do it because it doesn't require a get.
Okay, you just force the men to give a get.
Yeah, because then you end up with situations like what happened in New Jersey. The point is that Pilegesh is not the same thing as Nashim, as described here. And so he has many wives, and by the way, he has a Pilegesh in Shechem. So what's the big news about her? Yoldalo gam hi bein. She also had a son. So he's got 71. By his own Sanhedrin. Vayasim es shemo Avimelech. And of all the ones that he's going to name king, right, he picks the kid born from the Pilegesh. Something's wrong here. But
didn't Shlomo do something similar?
Oh, Shlomo has many wives, but those are wives.
But how do you designate the wife? Like, there's no marriage ceremony then, was there?
So no, it's just an agreement between the two of them to be together.
Was there any ketubah signed? No.
There's no ketubah for a pilagesh.
But for a wife.
Oh, for a wife? So, right, so there's a lot of discussion about when the ketubah begins, meaning the concept of ketubah is biblical. The legal document is understood generally, with some debate, but generally understood to be derabanan. The document itself and the specific payments that we do are generally understood to be rabbinic. They have found ketubot that go very far back, like period of the second base Hamikdash far back.
What I'm saying, does she think she's a Pilagesh? Is what I'm saying? Like, maybe she...
Oh, no. She's a Pilagesh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and that's going to be part of what's going to fuel things between Avimelech and his brothers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is the one they named Avimelech. Go figure.
They didn't even name her, either.
Right.
Did they name her?
She's not... No. Well, the other wives were named Rabot, apparently. He had many wives and a Pilagesh. Vayamas Gidon ben Yoash beseva tova. There's that ripe old age for Gidon. Vayikaver bekever Yoash aviv, and he's buried in the family mausoleum, the family plot, beOfra aviha Ezri, in Ofra of Aviezer. Aviezer was the family he was from. Vayikasher meis Gidon, and it was when Gidon died. Vayashuvu bnei Yisrael vayiznu achreya bealim. The Jews backslid. And they went after the Baal, which supports the message that it wasn't in Gideon's lifetime. Right? After he died, they went in. It's not an ironclad proof.
It says Vayashuvu, so they were doing it before, now they return and did it again.
Before Gideon. Right. The Avodah Zarah, like Gideon's father, had a Mizbeach for Baal.
But here it said, right when he made it, it said Vayiznu Kol Yisrael Acharav Sham. You think that's referring to later after he died?
What are you reading? Right, so that's the question. All the Mefarshim assume that this is after Gideon is dead, when it says that the Jews ended up spreading. Yes, that is after he's dead. And I think one of the reasons...
Because from before his time.
Yes, from when he was a kid. Or not even a kid, but I mean it's whatever it is, 33 years earlier, when they had all been worshipping Avodah Zarah. So they go after the Baal, Vayasimu lahem Baal baris le'elohim. And they set up Baal Brit, which is the name of one of the Baalim, as a god. We've said this before, that the Baalim plural, is because in each place you had a different Baal. There was Baal Peor as one example, so there's Baal Brit. That was the one that they had locally, and they set that up, Lelohim, as a god for themselves. The Jews did not remember Hashem, their God, who had saved them from their enemies. And they did not perform kindness with the house of Yerubal Gidon. Now he's got both names together. In accordance with all the good that he had done for the Jewish people. End of Perek. Okay. So... there are a lot of things we have to ask in this section, right? What should we be asking in these psukim?
In the past, have they always, done something for the family of the...
Well, no, but they promised here.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah. Like, you said you would, and you didn't. It's also a reflection of their lack of gratitude to God, right? They should have been grateful for the miracle that happened, and they follow instead Baal Brit and ignore God. And they should have been good to Gideon's household, like they promised, and they didn't follow through on that either. We'll see. The Malbim is going
to
make that
really
statement explicitly.
Well,
if you take the view that he was saying, "I'm not going to rule over you," right, as opposed to the view that he was saying, "I'm not going to rule over you myself. It's really God," in which case this is just inexcusable.
Maybe that's why he made the ephod as a deterrent.
As a deterrent for.
For the Avodah Zarah that he thought might be their pattern, and he was hoping to avoid it, and it didn't work.
How would the ephod be a deterrent?
Because it would be a reminder that it was Hashem who was there.
So he's trying to say it's from God by creating an ephod. I still come back to why in the world an ephod. Right? I think that's what's driving Abarbanel. A lot of what Abarbanel says is driven by the fact that you don't create a garment unless you plan for someone to wear it. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the answer is he created it for himself to wear as a royal garment, which makes sense, as opposed to random commemoration. It's not like garments figured into the victory.
Well, why didn't he use the purple stuff too if he's making it?
Oh, that was his, that was what he wore when he wasn't wearing the gold ring. I just like, it's not like this fit the battle. It had nothing to do with the storyline. Like, you could have made a gold decoration of somebody kneeling at a river to show all the people who he kicked out from the army. You could have, like, there were other things you could have made, like, random.
So why is the city and not, like, more public? Like,
what do you mean? How would you make it more public?
With a Mishkan.
Yeah.
Like, the Mishkan?
Maybe. Something more.
Right. It's a good thing he didn't. That's all we need. Let's put the idol in the Mishkan. The other thing that you have to catch here is, where is this Pelegesh? We're told where she lives.
Why?
Because what city is it? Shechem. Shechem is just like lightning rod. I mean, the first time Shechem shows up, it's the first place where Avram and Sarah camp when they enter the land. And that's, fairly benign, other than the fact that they were hungry because there was a famine. But other than that, it's basically a fine place. But then after that, it's all downhill. That's where Dina happens, and then Shimon and Levi. That's where Yosef is sold from. Like, this is a bad place. Sold from, by the way, by Midian. But this is the Pelegesh who's in Shechem. Yes, we have a problem. That's the upshot. Yehoshua, you may remember from the end of Sefer Yehoshua, gave one of his final speeches to the Jews. He has two final speeches, but one of them he gives also in Shechem. And I think that's part of commemorating what happened.
But she's not Nani, is she?
We don't know what she is.
We don't know.
We have no idea who she is. So the question is, how do we read all of this, and what are we supposed to see here? So we're not going to finish everything. But let's just note the opening pasuk in this section, pasuk chavtet, where we were told this seemingly useless piece of information. So Gideon went to sit at home. So what does that mean? So Radak and Ralbag say it means there's no more war.
Things were quiet.
Yeah, it means there's peace now. However, if you take a look at your sheet at Mitzudat David in source number 10, he gives you a different idea. He says Lo tarach harbe be'anagas ha'am. He didn't work hard at leading the nation. He seems to support the Abarbanel model that Gideon did become the leader, but he wasn't really interested in leading. He became the leader, and then he went home. Ki yasham beveso bimenucha. He sat at home at rest. Ula zehir ba nashimu banim. And that's why he had a lot of wives and kids, because he wasn't out there governing the nation. That's Mitzudat David's take. Yeah. So he was leading his own nation. He had 70 kids. That's a lot of kids. And I have to imagine there were a few daughters in there somewhere. How do you support them? With all the gold? Maybe he rented out. You could wear the ephod. Maybe that's why he became leader. The support. Yeah. So, God willing, next time, we will pick up with the rest of this story. And then it gets worse in Perek Tet when Abimelech comes along. But that's next week. And keep in mind, please, that for the next 2 weeks,